Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Perfect.
There we go.
All right.
So I'll let you kick it off.
All right. Hello, I'm Matt Hansen.
I'm Sean Eastridge.
And welcome to Filibuster. Hi, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Filibuster here at the Nerd Party. Another interesting review show we're going to have today as we talk about the brand new Christopher Nolan film, Dunkirk. And what I think,
all its epicness.
What I think is going to be cool is that Sean and I have quite different perspectives coming into a Christopher Nolan film, but I don't know. We might have more in common talking about this film than our perspectives on the director would lead us to believe.
Sure. I'm excited because I don't think we've ever had... You and I have not discussed Christopher Nolan.
No.
And it's interesting. It feels like in this day and age, there's almost a fanboy obligation to love Nolan. So it's very rare to find somebody who isn't necessarily a fan. Or not. I mean, not that you aren't a fan, but like you're more of a skeptic, as you were telling me.
Yeah. It's not... we'll get into it as we get into the review, but it's not that I dislike his films. I'm not one of those people that considers him cinematic's equivalent of the second coming of Jesus.
That's all right.
I think he does like really well made stuff, but it's often stuff that I feel satisfied seeing maybe once or twice.
Yeah, but not necessarily like, oh my God, he's a genius and he's one of the greats.
I don't worship at the throne of Christopher Nolan the way I do someone like Alfred Hitchcock or even Stanley Kubrick.
Sure, sure. And that'll be fun to discuss because, like I said, it's almost an anomaly to find somebody who, especially in the nerd world, is not like, oh my God, Christopher Nolan. But, so we'll definitely discuss that.
But speaking of the nerd world, Sean, before we get into Dunkirk and the review, lots of nerd stuff has happened this weekend because this past weekend, we're recording this on Sunday, July 23rd, we just had San Diego Comic-Con.
Yeah, tons of insane nerd news, trailers, all kinds of crazy stuff.
I'm sure you had plenty of things that you were looking at this weekend. Me personally, if anyone has been listening to me for the Nerd Party, as we've been around for 3 years, they know I am a diehard Marvel fan, so I was just waiting all day yesterday for their panel.
Hey, you and me both. I haven't been following the Comic-Con as far as what's coming up and stuff, so it's always been a pleasant surprise whenever I start seeing photos or videos from what's happening, like Blade Runner and all the stuff that's been coming out. It's been, again, I have not been tracking the news, so it's been every time I see a new trailer come up, it's like, oh great, they did a panel and now we have new material for it.
But I mean, we got some great... Marvel really came through yesterday, in my opinion, of course, but then again, I'm totally biased. I mean, they started off, one of the biggest announcements was for the Ant-Man sequel, the Wasp, the original Wasp, is going to be Michelle Pfeiffer.
That's so cool. I think that's great.
I think that's awesome. I love that, she's returning to comic book films again, because in spite of Nolan, I still say Michelle Pfeiffer was the best cinematic Catwoman. I like her better than Anne Hathaway.
I did like her, and I'm not a fan of Tim Burton's Batman movies, but I thought she was she's pretty great. And hey, I have a question. Are we going to have a Michael Keaton Vulture and Michelle Pfeiffer Wasp team up movie? Because hey, I'm putting it out there. I think that should happen.
I mean, it could happen. But, I mean, I wonder how they're going to use her because, if we remember from the first Ant-Man movie, she's been missing in the quantum realm that Paul Rudd got out of at the end of that movie. So maybe she'll get out of it in this movie. We'll see.
Right. Yeah, I'm not too familiar with Ant-Man as a character from the comics. I don't know if you've read those or...
I've not read the comics. I've been drawn into the Marvel world via the movies. So I'm learning along the way.
I'm the same way, with exceptions, obviously, like Spider-Man. But yeah, that's cool news. It is exciting to see Michelle Pfeiffer back in this world.
And the big release last night, because Marvel usually likes to hold on to all their trailers. They maybe put out one or two when Comic-Con happens, but like, they're holding out on Infinity War, which is fine by me. I mean, there's been a leak of the trailer, but it's just cam quality. So
yeah, I'm gonna wait for the real thing. I'm tempted, but I'm like, I'm just gonna wait it out.
But they actually the release from last night was the second trailer for Thor Ragnarok, and I didn't know how they were going to top that teaser, because that might be my favorite Marvel teaser.
It's so good.
I don't, you know, maybe they didn't top it, but they equaled it, because
yeah,
in this one it's just as sharp with the comedy, it's just as cool with the action, but this one we got a few more beats of plot.
Exactly. We got a little bit more about what direction this is going to be going in. And, you know, I'm completely... I am so excited for Thor Ragnarok. I'm not a fan of the Thor character. I find him kind of boring. And I didn't really like Thor. I thought the Dark World was okay. It didn't really do much for me.
But I think Hemsworth as Thor, though, I really do like. So.
I will say that. Hemsworth, the casting for Marvel, regardless of how you feel about the movies themselves, has been impeccable. And Chris Hemsworth is just further evidence of that. But, you know, I'm a massive fan of Taika Waititi, who is directing this, and he did, you know, What We Do in Shadows, Boy, Hunt for the Wilder People. He's such a creative director, and such a perfect choice for a character like Thor, who I think when you get stagnant with a character like that, it becomes very boring. So to bring in somebody like Taika, who is just so wild and so creative with that character, I think we are seeing evidence of it in the trailers already. Just the zaniness and just the visual madness that's on display. Like I can't wait, and I'm so excited to see. And I don't know. I mean, we're obviously both on board with it, but how do you think just general like fans of maybe comic books or superhero movies, how do you think they're reacting? I feel like I'm as a film fan, I'm excited because I'm a fan of the director. I feel like Thor needs to be a little bit more creative and a little zanier. Mm-hmm. He needs that in his life. But at the same time, I can totally see a backlash. I haven't read anything, but I can see people being like, oh God, Marvel's going full on comedy mode. I mean, are you getting that vibe, or do you, I mean, how do you feel about people who react in that
way?
Well,
I mean, from what I've seen, this is probably one of the most enthusiastic responses to a Marvel trailer from all audiences. I think because you look at these two trailers just for the third one, we haven't even seen the whole movie yet, but it looks so different from the first two, and I mean that in a good
way. It really
does.
So
it feels like, you know, some people call this a criticism, but I think it's silly. They're going more the Guardians of the Galaxy route, and that's fine, because I think that they figured out that that's what works for the cosmic end of the universe. So
yeah, it's okay for Thor to go a little bit more Guardians. I think he needs a little bit more of that zaniness in his life.
Right. I mean, we've done the two films where there was lots of Shakespearean drama and all that stuff, and I'm pretty sure there's going to be drama in this too. But I think the enthusiasm and the overwhelmingly positive reaction has to do with the fact that they're trying something very different with this franchise, and it looks like it's going to work. Full disclosure, but when the first teaser came out, I had not seen any of Taika Waititi's films. I had missed both of them, for, you know, my fault. But I've since watched What We Do in the Shadows. I Hunt for the Wilder People is still on my to-watch list before this movie comes out.
Oh, it's great. You've got to see it.
But once I saw What We Do in the Shadows, I got where everyone was coming from. And then when I saw this trailer last night, then I was able to, like, okay, now I recognize his humor. I mean, I was laughing during the first trailer, but now I have the context of, okay, yeah, this fits in with that director.
Yeah, it's got that very tossed-up improvised feel, especially, you know, the conversation where it's like, oh, we fought in battle, and he goes, did I win? No, I won easily. You know, it's just right. This very kind of quippy,
well,
like, fast-paced dialogue.
That doesn't make sense, but it's true.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm very excited. And then on the flip side of things, we have the Justice League trailer, and I don't think either of us are big DC movie fans at the moment. Did you get a chance to see that?
Yeah, I watched it this morning.
What are your thoughts?
I still am not sold on this movie. I just... And I hate to sound like the perpetual DC hater, but I feel like this film doesn't quite know what it wants to be. And it, I mean, it's gone through some hard circumstances, right? Because of the, you know, the tragedy with Snyder. And, you know, as much as I don't like him as a filmmaker, I'm not saying anything bad about him as a person through the tragedy. Yeah. But, like, that first trailer was so Snyderific, and it just was off-putting to me. And this one... It feels like I don't know how to describe this, because, you know, the person that they brought in to co-direct was Joss Whedon, who
and he's officially now a co-director. Right. They just announced that.
Right. And I loved the Avengers, and I'm one of the people that still, you know, for all of its flaws, liked Age of Ultron. But the trailer yesterday, it feels like this odd clashing of tones between, because I can recognize a lot of Snyder there. But the humor is coming through as Whedon, but it's not as sharp as it was when he was doing those Marvel movies.
No, it's not. I got that same vibe. I also, did you notice that the color scheme and the cinematography
felt very
toned down from the last trailer? Like, that was very stylized. It had that kind of what I like to call the Snyder filter, where everything is sort of saturated. It doesn't look quite real. But this, especially the scene with Wonder Woman.
The last trailer had like that blue Snyder filter, and this one, like toward the end when they're doing their CGI destruction, it has this weird red orange filter that looks odd.
It's got to be a clashing of the two directors, because Whedon's pretty standard as far as like he doesn't have a specific like you couldn't call him stylized. You can't go out there and be like, yes, that's a Joss Whedon movie. Other than the dialogue, you probably couldn't find his directorial style. You wouldn't be able to identify it. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this works, but I completely agree. Like the part where the Flash is like, oh, they kind of disappeared. That's rude. The jokes don't land.
Like, that's definitely Whedon, but I think it's, cause that's his style, sense of humor all over the place. But the difference is that I don't, because he probably wasn't involved, he definitely wasn't involved with the casting of these characters so far. These actors, you know, Ben Affleck is no Robert Downey Jr. He can't carry the humor like Downey can.
Yeah. And character, Batman in general, is not like fun and zany and ridiculous. You know, he's not comedically oriented like Tony Stark is.
And, you know, Ezra Miller's a good actor and other things, but again, humor's really flat. And I don't get this personally. I don't get this love affair with Jason Momoa. He seems really generic and bro-y to me.
Yeah, I can feel that. But whatever. We'll see how that turns out. And then any other trailers you were really excited about that came out of Comic-Con recently?
I mean, just the description of the Infinity War trailer has me hyped.
I'm really pumped for I loved Stranger Things, as I think 99% of viewers did. I'm very excited for season 2. I thought that trailer was great. I thought Ready Player One looked appropriately bonkers.
Yeah.
It's cool to see kind of the... I read the book and I liked it. I didn't love it like a lot of people did. I think it relies a little too much on 80s nostalgia. And this trailer definitely is relying on that too. But just something about seeing the DeLorean kind of going into a drag race was very exciting for me.
Well, so, I mean, this looks like I'll say this much. It looks like a better 80s nostalgia film than Pixels.
That's true. At the very least, this will hopefully be better than that. If not, then Spielberg might need to retire.
Right. But, that was cool. I mean, a huge Star Trek fan, so I loved watching the Star Trek Discovery panel and the trailer for that. I think that they're going in an interesting new direction that I hope lasts more than one season. You know, for me, it was just heartbreaking when Star Trek got canceled. And, you know, the movies have been great so far. I've enjoyed having a movie every few years. But having it back on television now, I don't think I could go through losing it again. So,
yeah, hopefully it sticks with it. I'm skeptically excited about that. I've been going through Next Generation for the first time and really appreciating Star Trek on a level I've never appreciated it on before. So I really hope Discovery manages to kind of recapture that cerebral more thoughtful nature of Star Trek. Nothing against the movies, which I've enjoyed, with the exception of Into Darkness. But I'm ready for Star Trek to be a bit more thought-focused as opposed to action-oriented.
Right. And there's definitely going to be action in this, because I feel like those movies, for better or for worse, have changed people's expectations of what Star Trek is. But I feel like, because it's episodic, there's going to be action, but there's going to be more time to focus on ideals than there is in a two-hour movie.
Sure, and you can't escape that. Abrams kind of brought this into the 21st century, kicking and screaming. Whether you like it or not, it's kind of the direction the Star Trek universe is going in. But yeah, so Comic-Con, lots of exciting trailers and stuff, but what do you say? Let's move into our Dunkirk discussion.
Definitely.
And, let's chat a little bit about Christopher Nolan, because I'm very interested to see what your opinion is. So how were you introduced to Nolan as a filmmaker, and what was it about it? Was there anything that you liked that he did versus what kind of made you sort of be a little bit more skeptical regarding his films?
Okay, so I got introduced to Christopher Nolan probably the way most people in my... I don't think we're that far apart in age, but my generation got introduced to him, which was probably through the Batman films.
Yeah.
He had done stuff before that, obviously, but nothing that would have gravitated toward my age. I think in 2005, when Batman Begins came out, I was 16. So that would have hit me at the right age level for a movie of his I would have seen.
Sure.
And I really liked Batman Begins. I remember having a lot of fun with it. I remember thinking it was cool. And I ended up liking all three of his Batman films, even Dark Knight Rises, as flawed as that film is. I found something to do enjoying all of them. It's just the reception around those films, especially the second one. I know it's a good film, but there was this, like... I don't want to say over-enthusiastic, because I don't want to like downplay other people's enthusiasm, but the enthusiasm level that was coming out of that film didn't match mine. I enjoyed myself. I thought everyone was great. I thought everyone gave really solid performances, but I wasn't like, this is God's gift to cinema. The way
I can understand that, and I kind of felt, you know, I, as much as I love The Dark Knight, I'm of the mindset I like Batman Begins more.
Batman Begins more as well.
Yeah, and the reason because of that is Batman Begins is a character-focused film. You're focused on Bruce Wayne and Batman, whereas Dark Knight is a bit more of an ensemble. It's more about tone than character. I mean, Harvey Dent probably would qualify as maybe, quote-unquote, the main character of that movie, but I felt like...
Yeah, his storyline at the end, I feel like the weakest resolved.
Yeah, it is definitely a tacked-on fourth act that... It is interesting that you bring that up, because I do think people are... Because people embraced The Dark Knight so enthusiastically, and because it immediately was labeled as a masterpiece and a game changer, and I mean it is arguably both. It's definitely a game changer. I'd probably call it a masterpiece, but I think a lot of people, because of their embracing of the film, were a bit inclined to turn a blind eye to its flaws, like the Harvey Dent tacked on Two-Face ending. And I also think the movie's plot doesn't necessarily hold up to scrutiny. If you start to analyze the Joker's plan and start to realize how many things had to happen a very specific way for his plan to work out, like he gets how would he know he got captured by Commissioner Gordon, and then he'd be able to bring a guy in with a bomb that would allow him to escape? You know, all these things kind of, it's like you start to think about it and it's like, huh. None of this actually makes any sense. But you know what? It's done so well, and its ideas are so fascinating, and it's so exciting to me. I feel like Nolan kind of dropped the ball with Dark Knight Rises, and all the plot problems that I would complain about with Dark Knight, he couldn't cover them up with the action or the character development, because for me at least, it wasn't there in Dark Knight Rises.
No, it felt
a little more obvious.
It wasn't there the way it was in the other two films, but hey, Man of Steel came out the year after Dark Knight Rises, and by comparison, Dark Knight Rises is a masterpiece.
This is true. My introduction was similar to yours as far as I saw Batman Begins. That was my introduction to Nolan as a filmmaker. I adored Batman Begins. I still, to this day, love it. I saw it. I was working at a movie theater, so this kind of makes this sound a little less pathetic because I got free tickets. I wasn't spending my own money, but I think I saw Batman Begins 10 or 12 times in theaters. Like, I was that obsessed with it.
That's okay. That's about how many times I saw Civil War last year, so you're good.
Good, perfect. So we're all right there. But I loved it, and I went back and, you know, I kind of explored his films. I went back and watched Memento, which I really loved.
Yeah.
I actually really enjoy Insomnia, which I think is underrated.
I agree. Well, that's an interesting perspective because I feel like a lot of Nolan fans kind of distance themselves from that one. Insomnia is actually toward the top of my list because I'll just say this much. When Interstellar was coming out, I went back and watched all of his films because I wanted to get more of a flavor for him. I think what made me a skeptic more than most things, I hate to say it this way, but it was like the hardcore fans, not you necessarily, like the ones that are open to criticism. I'm talking about the ones like, remember when Dark Knight Rises came out and the hardcore Nolanites were commenting on negative Rotten Tomatoes views? Remember Rotten Tomatoes Rotten Tomatoes back in the day, you could comment on people's reviews.
I remember that.
And they had to get rid of people, it because of The Dark Knight Rises.
Right. And again, Rises, I'm sorry. I know we have other Nerd Party members who love that movie and love Nolan. But to this day, the lack of recognizing that movie's flaws is baffling to me. Because every time I watch it, it is like bombarding me with like, this makes no sense. This is stupid. This is goofy. But I don't want to turn this into a Dark Knight Rises bash fest. But yeah, I totally... I think there's people who respect Nolan and people who are obsessed with him, and I kind of teeter that line a bit. I think I'm kind of exhausted.
But you're
by
not
people
like nasty about it. Is the
no,
thing.
I try not to be.
It was that level of nastiness that if you don't think he's the greatest filmmaker on earth, then there's something wrong with you.
Yeah, and you can apply that. I mean, to be fair, I think you can apply that to a lot of things that people... Like, I mean, you could even flip that and say people are the same way about Joss Whedon and say, like, he's perfect, and if you don't like him... You know, but I understand what you're saying, and I do think it's kind of amazing. But I think the reason with Insomnia, I think the reason I like it so much is it is... I think if you can knock Nolan on anything, it's that he kind of... it's kind of flash and pizzazz, but in a very like film oriented way. It's not like special effects, but he kind of switches up the narrative. Like Memento plays out backwards, so you feel like you are the main character.
And I sometimes feel like that's at a sacrifice of character development.
Yeah, you could call it a gimmick. You could, and you wouldn't be wrong. Which is why I think Insomnia impressed me, because there isn't really a gimmick to it. It's a straightforward film. Yes. Even Batman Begins, that I love, it does kind of have that sort of time manipulation where it's effectively done, but you know, you have Batman's story kind of unfolding for the most part at the beginning, not necessarily in a straightforward manner.
I think Insomnia 2 was... I watched that for the first time just after Robin Williams passed away. And it was such a different Robin Williams performance that I was just so totally impressed by that movie.
I completely agree. Sometimes I forget he was even in it, and then I remember, and I'm like, man, what? That speaks to his power as an actor, that I keep forgetting that he was in it, because he's so against type in that movie.
But he's so good. He pulls it off.
Yes, he's amazing.
So, I mean, Insomnia, the one that made me the angriest, like, it just, like, the ending totally frustrated me, was The Prestige. I don't like The Prestige at all.
It's been a while since I watched The Prestige. I'd like to watch it again, but I'm on the same page with you. I find The Prestige to be...
That was a gimmick.
Not as much... I don't dislike The Prestige the same way I dislike The Dark Knight Rises, but in the same way I don't understand the unanimous praise that Rises gets... The Prestige, the fact that people put that as like top five greatest films of all time, that drives me crazy, because it is such a, again, it relies on the crux of its concept that two, like, they have twins and there's a cloning machine. And I just found it ridiculous that, like, you remember in the beginning of the movie, Hugh Jackman and Christian Bale are always getting volunteers from their audience. Yeah. And they always pick each other, which allows for them to sabotage each other. And I was like, how do they keep picking each other? This makes no sense. And I thought the twist of Christian Bale having a twin brother was a little silly.
Yeah, it just... the ending just made me angry. It's just like, really? Yeah.
I would like to watch it again, but I'm with you. I don't think The Prestige is particularly amazing.
And
it's decent.
And I would say the same thing. I don't hate it as much as I did The Prestige's ending, but I kind of felt like Interstellar was an interesting movie, but like kind of a mess.
I agree with you there, but I actually fell on the side of really enjoying Interstellar, which shocked me because I was ready, since I had had such a strong negative reaction to The Dark Knight Rises, I was like, Nolan was on my bad side. He was on my naughty list, and I was ready to go out and hate Interstellar, and I was shocked to find that I ended up really enjoying it. But I, despite all that, it is kind of a mess. It's way too long. And the goofy ending of, like, love will bring us all together through every dimension.
It's the whole, once I realized that that whole Anne Hathaway's thesis about love is more than an equation or is an equation or something like that. Once I realized that was the thesis of the movie, I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. And then that book scene at the end.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful idea, but in a movie that's very calculated and very scientific, it felt a little silly.
Right. Especially since
more than a little silly. It yeah. was very silly.
Yeah, you're right. That movie was like so trying to be ultra scientific at that point.
Yeah, it was very cerebral, so all of a sudden it's like, no, it's about thinking. It's like that awful line in Lost in Space where Will Robinson tells the robot, it's about thinking with your heart instead of your head. And I think that's what Interstellar, it kind of pulls the rug out from under you, and it's like, right? And it's like, no, wait a second, this doesn't make sense.
So, I mean, I there are things I liked about Interstellar, and there was more that I liked about Interstellar than like The Prestige, but the ending really put me off. And also too, I felt like the whole, this is not an Interstellar review, but I felt like the whole middle section with Matt Damon was so unnecessary. That didn't need to be in the movie.
Sure. It was a strange attempt to kind of create some conflict. I recognized it as a forced plot point, but at the same time, again, I was on board with the movie almost against my wishes. I was like, oh, I like this and I want to hate it, but I don't. We skipped over Inception, which I think is one of the great movies. I don't know how you feel about that, but I absolutely adored it.
It was very interesting. I haven't seen it in a while. I remember thinking visually it was so striking. I want to see it again because when Inception came out, I had just turned... That was 2010, I think. I had just turned 21.
Okay.
And I remember liking it, but I don't think I understood a lot of it. I think I would like to see that again at some point with an older person's brain.
Sure. And did you see Following? I realize we skipped Following.
I did see Following when I was watching up to Interstellar. And that was it was an interesting little short film, but there's not a lot to it.
Yeah, it's easy to forget about Following because it is kind of forgettable, but it is... It's more impressive going back and watching it, knowing that, you know, Nolan basically got a band of friends together and would make this movie on the weekends. It's like, that's pretty awesome. The fact that movie feels professional in any way, that it works, considering the relative inexperience of pretty much everyone involved, that is pretty incredible. Plus, there's the scene where the guy walks to the apartment and there's a Batman sticker on the door, which is like, oh,
foreshadowing.
Now it all makes sense. Exactly.
But leading up to Dunkirk, my two favorite Nolan films were Memento and Insomnia.
Sure. And those are great choices. I would say probably definitely Dark Knight and Batman Begins, but I really loved Memento and Inception as well. I'm a fan. I mean, it feels like as I'm talking about it, I feel like I'm nitpicking, but I want to make it clear. I definitely love Nolan. I do think he's one of the great filmmakers of our day and age. And
I would agree with that.
Yeah. And I you know, leading, he is kind of the next Spielberg in a way, where it's like now Christopher Nolan is a household name.
Yeah.
You go to see a Christopher Nolan movie.
Oh, for sure.
In a way that's kind of... almost disappearing a little bit. I mean, film fans like us, we can recognize, oh, yeah, it's directed by this person.
There's not a lot of auteurs these days, and he's one of them. And when I say I'm a Christopher Nolan skeptic, it's not that I don't think he's a great director. I think he's so talented. I think he makes good films. Clearly, there's something about him that just works as a director. What makes me skeptical is that the insistence that he's the greatest filmmaker of all time, quote unquote.
Yeah,
the people who don't acknowledge that there is some flaws. Like, I love Alfred Hitchcock, but every Alfred Hitchcock film to me is perfect.
Sure. So your skepticism is understandably a result of fanboys just
overhyping
unquestionably
things.
Yeah, exactly. Which, you know, that's completely, I get that, and it is frustrating. But you know, you take what you can get. And in this case, how did you feel about Dunkirk as you started seeing previews? Were you excited for it at all? Like, was it something on your radar at all? Or was the fanboy like, Dunkirk, the next Nolan film? Was that kind of overwhelming?
Here's the surprising thing. The answer to whether or not I was looking forward to this one is yes. Because even though, like, I was a skeptic about Nolan, I love World War II movies. It's just one of my favorite genres. There's something about World War II, and I was discussing this with my friend who came with me to the screening after the movie. There's something about World War II where it's really exciting to be there because it felt like it was the last quote unquote good war, where we knew who the bad guys were, we knew who the good guys were, and there was a clear side between good quote unquote and evil quote unquote. So
yeah, I agree, and I think that's what the appeal of that war is. It was
a righteous war.
Yeah, it was maybe the last time in America's history that we were unquestionably the good guys in a war. I think that's the appeal. You get to see, you don't have to watch it with the skepticism. There's no skepticism involved. You don't have to feel that when you're watching a film or when you're learning or reading about these people that you have to be like, oh, but they had a dark side. I mean, obviously no one is perfect, and I'm sure the soldiers, there was some sketchy stuff going on.
We see it in this film. Like, not everyone in this film is perfect, but we know in general who the good people were, who the bad people were.
Exactly. And I think there's people get a lot of comfort from that and being able to really praise the heroes as what they were. They were heroes, and there's no catch to it.
I mean, there's a reason that generation's called the greatest generation, quote unquote.
Exactly. So you were excited. World War II is a genre
I was also excited for the fact that because, you know, I saw the trailers and I'm like, oh, this is very interesting because a lot of World War II movies are coming from the perspective of the American Army. Because, you know, Hollywood, we make American films and, you know, Saving Private Ryan, all that sort of stuff, PT-109. They come from the perspective of the American Army, but, like, I also like reading history, so I've read a lot about World War II. And, you know, I kept thinking all this time, well, yeah, we did really good things for the war. We certainly helped turn the tide, but there was a point there where, like, Britain had to hold the fort for Europe by themselves for about a year. So
yeah, exactly.
I was really excited to see a World War II movie coming from the perspective of the British Army because I feel like we don't get that a lot.
Yeah, and made by a British filmmaker too, who was raised learning about this, and you know, having Nolan make this movie coming from that environment is, I think, key in a lot of ways to telling this story correctly.
So I was really looking forward to seeing it from the British perspective, knowing that I had a lot of respect for their army standing by themselves for a year and yet never surrendering. So that was what I was hoping to get out of this movie.
Yeah, and it's funny, again, Dark Knight Rises was the movie that kind of put Nolan on my naughty list. Interstellar I enjoyed despite myself, but even Dunkirk, I think I can speak to your annoyance with people who love Nolan. As much as I love Nolan, it is kind of annoying to be surrounded by film devotees who are like, Nolan, 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 and like throwing his movie out as like, this is what I want. And I saw the previews and I was like, yeah, it looks good. It looks good. I'm excited, sure. But you know, it wasn't really on my radar the same way like maybe like Spider-Man was, or Thor, or or even like anything like that. I kind of, it's weird. Yeah. I wasn't necessarily I wasn't not looking forward to it, but it wasn't on my radar. And I am a fan of World War II. That sounds terrible to say it that way. I love World War II's history. I love reading about it. I love movies about it. I love the stories and the heroism involved. I love hearing about that and reading about it. So, but again, you know, it wasn't really something where I was really paying Dunkirk much attention. I was looking forward to it, but not in a way that was anything more than the films I was most excited to
see
this year.
I mean, that's so weird, because I mean, I wouldn't say that I was looking forward to it as much as like Guardians and Spider-Man this summer, but I definitely saw that trailer early on and I'm like, am I actually excited for a Christopher Nolan movie? I think I am. So I dare I say it, maybe I was even a little bit more excited than you.
Sounds like it. That's so, it is. It's strange. It's weird how that happens. But how did you see the movie? Did you see it in 70 millimeter?
I did, because I mean, the one thing I do respect about Nolan is that he's a film fan and a movie history fan. So I really appreciate his attempts to preserve the use of film in making movies. So I definitely wanted to see this in 70 millimeter because, you know, movies like that aren't released a lot today. The only place in Tucson that was showing it like that was the indie movie house that just got renovated and had an exclusive engagement with the 70 millimeter. Not an IMAX, but I did see it in the 70 millimeter with the proper sound system.
Oh, great. So what was the 70 millimeter presentation like? Was it just crisper? Was the picture just better?
The picture,
I'm trying to figure out what it is about. Like if I see this again, should I go see it in 70 millimeter?
I think you
or
should, because okay. For me, the experience with 70 millimeter, and I saw Interstellar in 70 millimeter as well. My experience with 70 millimeter is not only is the picture cleaner and crisper and brighter, the sounds are so much more visceral. Like in this one, this is not a scary movie by any means, but I got startled a few times with the guns going off because it sounded it was right in the room with me. That's how pristine and clear it was. So I think if you're going to see this movie, I think if you have a 70 millimeter presentation in your town, that's the way to go, because it was so much more engaging and visceral, and it felt like I was there.
Yeah, and I was lucky enough that there was one location in the state of Georgia playing the 70 millimeter IMAX presentation, and it was about a 30 minute drive from me. So I drove 30 minutes to go see it, and I was nervous. I was like, oh, I hope this actually is an IMAX theater, but it was legit. They had the giant screen, and it was a legitimate 70 millimeter IMAX presentation of it. And I'm with you. I think if you are near a 70 mil, if you're near a theater playing it in 70 millimeter, or if you are by a theater doing 70 millimeter IMAX, that is the way to see it. That's the way Nolan shot it. It's the way he intended it to be seen. And like you said, as kind of Nolan's kind of a defender of this dying art of respecting film and using film instead of digital and things like that. And, you know, we can debate the merits of digital versus film all we want. I know even Roger Deakins, maybe the greatest cinematographer working in this day and age, has basically said, oh, digital, there's no difference. But, you know, just seeing this movie and seeing it in that format,
I've seen a lot of movies in recent time, and nothing is compared to when I see things in 70 millimeter. Because, like, back in October, this same indie movie house does actually 70 millimeter showings of movies on a regular basis, and I saw Aliens in 70 millimeter, and that's a film that I've seen many times. It's one of my favorite movies of all time, and I had never seen it like that before. The pulse rifles, the motion track, everything was so loud and so crisp and so wonderful that I have a real hard time believing, as great as Roger Deakins is, and I agree he's probably the best cinematographer working today, there's something different about film. And I don't know about you, but you know, you and I are both old enough to remember when movies at the cinema were film, and there was something so gratifying about going to this movie, not only hearing the sounds in the movie, but just hearing the sound of the projector reel as it was clicking along with the film.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. No, there is an undeniable appeal to it. And watching this film, there's an undeniable texture to it. You feel it feels like it. You know that there's something that because it's real and it was shot on film, maybe this is pretentious and kind of a film snobby thing to say, but it feels more real.
Yeah.
It just, you feel it more, and you being it, knowing that it was shot on film, it gives you so much more respect to the filmmakers.
And it was
involved.
Like, I didn't realize how much I missed this. Like, because we're so spoiled by digital now. It's like, when we go back to film, it's like, oh my God, we had it so good.
And it's funny because I shared an article, because Nolan obviously made that very quote-unquote controversial statement about how he'll never work with Netflix because they don't do theatrical distribution. And I shared it on my wall, and of course people are debating it. My wife's even debating it with me. And it's really, at the end of the day, it's like, yes, consumers are going to access films in a way that is most convenient to them. And theater prices, tickets are going up. It's becoming ridiculous. I spent $23 to see this movie in IMAX 70mm.
Yeah.
So it's like, I get the frustration.
But I feel like they pulled that quote to generate clicks, because he wasn't saying,
of
like,
of course.
The thing makes it sound like he's saying, well, I'm too good for Netflix. And that's not the context at all. You just can't do 70mm or film on Netflix.
It's completely true, and I think Dunkirk is, in this decade, maybe the finest argument for seeing a movie in theaters on as big a screen as possible as I can remember seeing. I think the last thing I would say, like, absolutely see it in a theater was Mad Max Fury Road or Gravity by Alfonso Cuarón. Well, with that being said, Matt, what did you think of Dunkirk? Aside from, like, the impressiveness of the format and the presentation, did you enjoy it as a film?
So every summer for the last, maybe not every summer, but like in summer 2014 and 2015, I had experiences where I was looking forward to one film majorly during the summer. And while I still liked it, there was something that came up in July that was like my dark horse favorite and ended up being my movie of the year. For 2014, that was Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
And for 2015, that was Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. I thought this year it was probably going to be War for the Planet of the Apes, which, I think is a good movie. But I ended up not liking it as much as Dawn. And then I saw this film, and I have to say, despite being a Christopher Nolan skeptic, this is probably going to be my dark horse favorite of the summer.
It's funny. I had the same exact reaction to Dawn and War. Loved Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Enjoyed War, and I was expecting that to be my movie of the summer. But it wasn't, and I was a little disappointed in it. And again, I went into Dunkirk kind of not necessarily low expectations, but almost not sure what to expect, and I'm right there with you. This is one of the most powerful film-going experiences I've ever had, and as I said, I think it is one of the best arguments for going to see a movie in theaters the way it should be seen, and being willing to spend the extra money, because my God, seeing that in 70mm IMAX and feeling, like you were saying, it is so visceral, and you feel like you were there. And I think that's what Nolan intended, was you are kind of a part of the story. You're not observing it from like a detached perspective. You are in there. And when the gunfire goes off, you are it's startling, but not in a cheap way where it's like a jump scare. You feel like you were part of it.
It was kind of a jump scare for me, but it wasn't like an annoying, like the horror movie jump scares, but like guns would go off at unexpected times, and you know, of course it was like that when you were there, but it would startle me, and the person who I was going with, it was like I kept jumping in my seat whenever the guns would go off. and he turned to me and was like, "Are you okay?" And I'm like, yeah, it's loud, but it's good.
Yeah, but it's beyond the guns. I mean, it is an intense film. There was never a moment where I was not like just gripping my chair or just like I was so engaged.
I have to
engaged.
Say we're probably going to head into spoiler territory at this point, but if you haven't seen it yet, go see it. You know, the skeptic and the fan both recommend it. Just put it
absolutely
that way. So we're going into spoilers now. This movie is shorter than a lot of Christopher Nolan movies have been in recent times.
Yeah.
And it's 106 minutes as opposed to like 3 hours. So it's just over an hour and a half. But it felt longer than that, but not in a bad way, because I have to say, from the moment it starts, this is a 106-minute exercise in tension and suspense. Like, there's never a moment where there wasn't tension. Even at the end, when they were okay, I kept expecting something bad to happen, even though I know from history that they got back okay.
Yeah, and I completely agree. It is kind of funny because I think a lot of people, even Nolan fans, were like, "Wait a second, it's a war film, but it's rated PG-13, and it's Nolan, but it's under 2 hours." And I think even the biggest Nolan fan was kind of looking twice at that point and saying,
"Did the studio compromise?
Yeah, is something going on? Like, what happened here? Is this going to hold up?" So yeah, the length of the film, I think a lot of people were skeptical about it, but it is so effective because you can only really maintain that level of suspense and intensity for so long before it becomes exhausting. I think Nolan himself said,
I mean, I was
exactly
exhausted,
that.
But like in a good way. Like I felt exactly. like I had just been through an experience when I left.
This could not have been maintained over 2.5 hours. I think it would have started to get repetitive. So it is actually even more effective because of its length, because it's shorter. And I give full props to Nolan for just keeping it as distilled and as condensed as possible to be as effective as possible.
And there's a lot of Nolanism still in this as well, because, I mean, we're well into spoiler territory now, so we'll just go ahead and start talking about the film. The film itself is told in three parts that all vary in terms of where they are and when they are. It took me less so than other Nolan films, but it took me a minute to say, okay, the stuff with the beach is happening first. The stuff right. with the Tom Hardy is happening second, and the stuff with Mark Rylance and the civilians is happening last.
I picked up on it pretty early, and it's partially because of my familiarity with Nolan and the way he likes to manipulate time in his movies.
I should have realized that as I was going into it, but then I saw like events start to repeat themselves, and I'm like, oh, of course, nonlinear storytelling, that's a Nolan trademark.
Right, and it was great because, and it's kind of funny because one of the most maddening things to me is when people arrive to a movie late, and there were people arriving 20 minutes into this movie, no joke, like crowds of people arriving 20 minutes. They paid $23 for this movie, and they were arriving late. So I almost felt like it was a big middle finger, not like in a malicious way, but it was almost as Nolan was saying, like, look, if you're not here from the beginning of this movie, you are missing the experience. Because at the very beginning, he lays out the three stories. And it says, you know, one, the mole. And it says, I think, 1 week. Mm-hmm. I think it says something like 1 week away. And then they have, the sea, which is 1 day. And then the air, which is one hour.
Yeah.
So pretty early on, when I started to see the thing, I was like, okay, I think these three stories are taking place in different time periods. And that was confirmed, like you were saying, by the repetitive events. And when I was like, okay, cool.
I started seeing people from the other two stories in one of the stories. And, you know, I eventually caught on. And it took me, I'll give myself credit, it took me less time to catch on this than another Nolan film. So maybe I'm just learning him better, or maybe it's because I'm drawn in more. I was paying attention more.
I just thought it was so funny. I was like, you stupid jerks who came in late to the movie theater, you have no clue what's happening. And by the end, I mean, everyone's pretty much on board. But I love that Nolan, he is one of the biggest filmmakers right now, but unlike a lot of big filmmakers, he still challenges his audience with things like that.
Right.
He expects you to
pay attention.
You better be paying attention. And you better be willing to meet him halfway, because if you're not, you're going to miss out on the experience.
Yeah, that's one of the things I do like about him. Now, sometimes the payoff isn't necessarily what I like, but I do enjoy active participation in a movie. In not in terms of like we're speaking along with the dialogue, but like active participation is like I am looking for clues. I'm looking for crossover. I'm looking for something to give me a hint of where this is going.
Yeah, exactly. And it really is he masterfully intercuts this stuff. And again, you could call it a gimmick. It is technically a Nolan gimmick. Dunkirk does not escape from that. But it is so effectively done, and it really contributes to the mood of the film. The three stories that are unfolding simultaneously in different times eventually reach a culminating point where that you could argue that kind of intercutting and that kind of playing with time was necessary to tell the story in an effective way that milks all the suspense you can possibly get.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, once you once you catch on to where all the stories are taking place, it's easily, what I appreciate about it and what I don't always get from Nolan films is that this was pretty much easy to follow, because I think it was because it was a historical event. After this film, can I just say that, like, I hope Nolan does more historical dramas, because I think that that would, I think actually that would suit him. Like, I think that that was something different that I hadn't gotten from any of his previous films, because they're all creative, you know, originally created stories. And I'm sure some of the facts here are exaggerated as well, but I would love to see him do real takes on battles or, historical events. I think that would be great.
Yeah, I think Nolan has one of his flaws is he can get convoluted the more he has to play. Like, with an original story, Interstellar got convoluted. Dark Knight Rises got convoluted. Even Dark Knight was convoluted. You know, I know he wrote Dark Knight with Jonathan Nolan, but Dunkirk, maybe because of the fact that he was so interested in reflecting and fully kind of translating this story to film without any frills or anything like that, that may have been why it's so effective. So to see him kind of at the service of a story that's not necessarily his to tell was very effective, and I think played a part in why this movie worked so well.
Yeah, I could definitely get behind Christopher Nolan if he was like, if he spearheaded the return of the epic battle film.
Oh, yeah, that would be amazing. But again, I think part of what I love about Nolan is his...
He changes it up.
Yeah, and he's not necessarily what I'd call an action director. I mean, he's made, Inception, Dark Knight, but even those, I don't really, except for Inception with the hallway fight, right, where it's twisting
the
around.
The action is never the standout thing.
Exactly. It's never, the reason I watched The Dark Knight is not necessarily for the action, although the car chase is amazing.
Yes.
And one of the best
but
I've
like,
seen.
But like I watch the, it. When Batman gets into fisticuffs, it's not necessarily visually striking.
Exactly. And that's why I think Nolan, even though I would love, I agree with you, there's a part of me that would love to see a big battle from him. I think the strength of this movie is that it's not kind of what we've seen before. It's not necessarily like, oh, here comes another big battle. It's very grounded in the human. It's the eye level of the humans kind of like interacting and seeing everything happening and being in the midst of that. And you feel like you are in the midst of everything. And it's, even, I mean, it is incredible. I think, especially the mole, that storyline with, the kids who are trying to get on the boats.
Look it up. Is that where One Direction kid got in? Is that him? His storyline?
Yes, Harry Styles is in there. All three stories are effective in their own ways, but I remember the sequence when they are on the boat.
Yes.
And it gets hit by the torpedo and they are
all...
Oh,
that boat. Because they're on several boats. These people are really unlucky with boats.
It's not very specific to say the scene where they're on a boat, because they are on like multiple boats the entire movie. But the one where they think it's at night and they think they've made it to safety and they're locked inside, and then they get hit by the torpedo and they nearly drown until the guy who is revealed to be French later on saves them and opens up the door. That was like, I just remember that was the moment I was on board with the film, but that was when I was like, oh, this is an absolute masterpiece. This is an absolute, Nolan has a complete understanding of the effectiveness of how to tell a story with visuals and sound. Cause it was so, I felt like I was like trapped in there with them.
Yeah, and
I was very involved with
that. It was really cool because there was a lot of boats capsizing in this movie as soon as they got torpedoed. And I had not seen, like, I can't think of too many movies, you know, aside from like your CGI adventures or like Poseidon Adventure back from the 70s, where you have like a boat that's capsizing in the middle of a film. I had never seen, like, there's this shot during certain capsizing scenes where, like, just, like, this wall of water comes rushing toward the people from the side of the frame, and I don't think I've ever seen something like that before.
Yeah, the way he shot it is they have the camera on the side of the boat, so you're with the people as it's tilting over, but the way it looks, it's, because the camera is on the boat, it looks like the water is coming towards them.
Yeah.
So it is a fascinating visual, and I don't know how to pronounce the cinematographer's name. I think it's Hoyte de Hoyema.
He's the one who shot Interstellar, and he also shot Spectre, the last James Bond movie.
Yeah, and he also did Let the Right One In, which is a beautiful film. And I don't know where Wally Pfister went, but I'm perfectly happy with Hoyema being here.
He did Transcendence, and then he disappeared.
I think he might be on a sabbatical or something, trying to find himself after that experience. But this is a overwhelmingly beautiful film. Like, the visuals, and again, this is why I think people should see it in 70mm and in IMAX if they have availability, if that's available to them, because it part of the experience is just those overwhelming visuals. And I remember, like, just seeing it in IMAX, and especially the fighter pilot scenes, it's just like this vast expanse of ocean, and there are points where I felt like I was going to fall into the water. I felt so, like, a part of that. And it's insane that, I mean, Nolan is, again, as much as I didn't like The Dark Knight Rises, it's impressive to see him devoting so much of his energy and craft to practical effects and to insisting on practical effects, because I think this movie is like, those are real planes.
Yeah, I was going to say, if there's CGI in this movie, I didn't catch it.
Yeah, it is completely believable, and having the real planes, having the real boats, and I think even the actors were actually in planes, and they built special cockpits so that the real pilots could fly in there, to actually fly the plane. So it's like, you're seeing footage of them flying. It is just... no filmmaker is really doing anything on this scale with that level of reality to it. And it makes a huge difference. Like, you buy into this world and what's happening completely. There's never a moment where you do not feel like, oh, this is happening and this is horrible.
Right. The only, I wouldn't even call it a criticism, because it didn't affect my enjoyment of the movie at all. But the only downside I could point out to this is that, unless you paid more attention than I did you really catch anybody's name in this film?
No.
Like, character names?
No.
The only thing is like, because the whole time I'm talking about this film to my friend or other people, I'm like, and I'm saying, like, so Tom Hardy's in the plane, and Cillian Murphy's with Mark Rylance in the boat, and the guy from One Direction's on the beach. Like, I'm referring to them by their real life names, because I didn't catch who any of these people were. Ultimately, that really doesn't matter, because you're more invested in the stakes and the drama of it, but I don't know anybody's name.
Yeah, and I think that's what a lot of critics have been complaining about, is there isn't a lot of character development per se. You don't know who these people are. You don't know how they got involved. See, you don't know their backgrounds.
The character development and backgrounds I'm okay with, because we're in the middle of a war. It would have felt odd, given that this movie has so much tension, to, like, now we have to pause to tell the backstory of the One Direction kid, and we have to pause to tell, you know, I got enough from what they were doing. Far as character developments, the only thing that bothered me is, like, I don't know what to call them except their actor names.
Yeah, it's funny. I didn't think about that until now with you pointing it out, because, again, it is Nolan as a visual storyteller taking full advantage of his craft. I mean, he is a master of his craft, and he devoted, I know I've seen interviews with him, and I've read interviews with him where he talked about, like, he wanted it to just be an experience. And part of that is, you know, we don't know their names, because they don't tell each other their names.
Right.
You know, the French kid never speaks in the entire movie until they point out that he hasn't spoken. And you realize, you're like, oh my God, yeah, he hasn't spoken to them. And,
but even like the three planes up in the air, they're referring to each other by their call signs rather than, you know, their last names or, you know, whatever. Or the guys on the beach, the higher ups, they're calling each other, you know, lieutenant and general. They're calling each other by rank. I never heard a last name.
It's true. And I find it really impressive that, regardless, we still empathize with them, and it almost doesn't even matter.
You're right.
Like you're saying.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like, I don't point this out as, like, this was bad about the movie. I would have liked maybe putting a name with a face, but ultimately it really didn't matter, because the drive of this movie isn't necessarily the character backgrounds. It's not important where they came from. It matters that they're there and they're trying to get home. And this is in the middle of, you know, France surrendering and Germany taking over. And so it's all about the tension, and maybe rightfully so, because, I mean, we mentioned on this podcast, I haven't been terribly enamored with how Nolan does characters in the past. So
yeah.
just don't worry about it. Have them do logical things for people who are there in the war, and don't get it bogged down in the philosophizing or convolutingness of something like an Interstellar. And actually, that worked better for me.
It is, and it's almost the anti-Interstellar in a way, and even anti-Nolan for his past couple of films, because, again, if you could knock them for anything, it's bloat, and, you know, how the storylines get more convoluted, and this is just raw storytelling. You know, it is boiled down to its absolute essentials, and it works, and it really does work better than I think a lot of his more even The Dark Knight, which I love, and would probably, if I were to rank his movies, put The Dark Knight higher.
It's still a little too long.
Yeah, Dunkirk to me is almost more effective at what it's trying to do because of its brevity and its simplicity.
Like, I kind of feel as soon as Joker exits The Dark Knight, I kind of feel like I do too, pretty much. Because, like, the fourth act is not really anything special. Personally, yeah. I think. But at no point in this movie did I feel like there was unnecessary bloat or anything out of the ordinary. Oh, I lied. I did catch one name, because the poor kid who dies, the 16-year-old, I know his name is George.
George, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that is...
That was brutal. Man, like, we had...
It was.
Like, God. And I had a feeling that he would die, but, like, when they announced that he actually had died, there was a lot of gasps in my audience. Like, we didn't think it was actually going to happen.
It was a brutal moment, and it was... It's funny, because a lot of... I've seen critics almost grasping for something to...
criticize.
To criticize in this film, and they've talked about, like, oh, it's emotionally cold, it doesn't have that human connection. I never once felt that. I was completely emotionally invested.
Everyone was stunned, and it's not that, you know, it's I don't think it's an emotionally cold. It's just happening in this greater context of this huger battle. So, like, we have these moments of loss, but we can't focus on them because we still have a job to do. And that's what
that's what the
Mark Rylance characters thought always, and that's what the blonde-haired kid that was with them that wasn't the kid that died. See, again, no names, so I have to describe them.
No names. So, Mark Rylance and Mark Rylance's son.
Right, that's what they realized. And I thought it was really effective because, you know, the poor guy dies because Cillian Murphy has PTSD and knocks him out.
And yeah, it's the perfect example of what we're saying where, you know, this was a war of heroes where we knew who the good guys were and who the bad guys were. But even there, there's a blurred line with Cillian Murphy. He murdered this kid.
Unintentionally,
obviously not intentional. But, you know, he obviously has seen some stuff, and it's affected him in a very profound way.
One of the most
positive.
You know, for being quote-unquote emotionally cold, one of the most emotional moments for me was that, you know, right after the kid died, the other kid goes to Cillian Murphy, who's saying something like, he's going to be all right, right? He's just kind of repeating that. And he just looks at him for a second, and he goes, yeah, he's going to be all right, like not wanting to upset him even more.
That's the thing. There were so many powerful moments. I was very emotionally moved by it at multiple points. That was one of them. I think that, you know, when the boy ultimately delivers the information to his newspaper, and then also just Tom Hardy's heroism, his character being willing to sacrifice himself to save the people on the beach.
He ends this movie. I don't think he gets killed, but he's definitely a POW by the end of this film.
Exactly. He gets captured. But again, I found that extremely moving, and it was... I don't know what the definition of emotionally cold means, because I've never felt that way about any of Nolan's movies, even the ones I don't necessarily like.
Well, I mean, there is sort of a...
maybe it's the British mentality.
I think
it is the British mentality.
I really do think it is, because, I mean, I would describe something like Memento as emotionally cold, but not because it's bad, but because, like, it's very stark, and it's very, very... you know, uptight, and it doesn't explore deeper emotions. The only time he really did that was Interstellar, and that was the part of Interstellar I didn't like. So
and even Batman Begins is very emotionally resonant, more so I think than The Dark Knight or Dark Knight Rises, because it's so focused on Bruce Wayne's character. But I don't know. I was emotionally connected. I was moved, and I was completely invested in every way. I think beyond, it would be interesting to see this movie in like a regular format. Like I'm interested to see how I react when I get it on Blu-ray and just have my normal TV to watch it on. But I don't think it's any less effective regardless. I mean, you should see it in as huge a format as you can, but the storytelling is still strong.
Yes,
regardless.
I agree. And I think that part of it too is like, I love a good historical movie where I can be in suspense of are they going to make it when I know they are going to make it. It is going to be successful. I think the last time I experienced something like that was maybe Argo when that came out. Like, I knew those people were going to get out of there, but I had, you know, the whole time I'm like, are they going to get caught? You know, I like it when a movie can fool me into being scared for people that I know are going to survive.
And it's because I think a lot of Dunkirk, even though it's based on real events, these characters are fictional technically, so they could die. Yeah, you don't know, and you're invested, and you want them to survive just because the alternatives are so brutal and horrifying.
So, do you have like? I mean, I know the whole movie was tense, but like, did you have a specific moment of tension that really stood out for you? Because for me, where I thought you were going to go when you were talking about the torpedo earlier is I was the most tense when they were hiding in another boat and they were using it for target practice. Remember how the bullets kept coming through?
Yeah, jeez. This movie it literally is 100 minutes of like you were gripping your chair. That got me good too. Just like, and when the water starts pouring
and is that guy going to murder the French guy? Like,
yeah, that was a moment because for the most part throughout the movie we've had people, they're all helping each other. You know, humans are, you know, Cillian Murphy's character is not actively sabotaging things. He tries, but then he stops.
He's shell-shocked. He has PTSD.
Yeah, and we also knew from the beginning when we met his character that there was something wrong. But with these kids, we've been along the ride with them, and they've been helping each other out. So to see them turn on each other like that was almost more disturbing, you know, to see them kind of, it's like, wait, no, you guys are good. Like, you guys are friends. You're helping each other.
Yeah, not only
you now trying to kill each other?
At first they think he's a German because he hasn't said anything. And I kept thinking, oh yeah, this one was called the Mole. Is he a German mole? Is he a spy? Is that how they always know where they are? And no, he's a French guy who just wants to get off the mainland like the other French guys were trying at the beginning of the film, and the British weren't letting them on. And once that was established, I'm like, you guys are supposed to be on the same side.
Yeah, it was a very intense moment that showcases both the good and the bad of what these soldiers were experiencing and the way they behaved. And that moment definitely got me. I think honestly, the moment of tension, I don't think anyone's a fan of drowning, but I have a particular fear of that. So anything that was like underwater with them being trapped in some way was like, ugh. It always, the whole sequence
then,
of them,
well,
like where you thought they were going to die and then he saved them by opening the door.
That was
like,
good.
Oh,
and,
my God.
Well, and then toward the end, when you add oil into the water where like everyone's going to catch on fire. If anyone in the water is going to catch on fire if something ignites it.
Yeah, and the fighter pilot in his cockpit unable to get the window. Him kind of slowly sinking into the water. But the other moment that I was very like, come on, let's go, was Tom Hardy going after the bomber.
Yes,
and like you're just like, God, just get him, you can get him. And it was, I wanted to cheer, but I was so emotionally drained by that point. It was just like, good.
By that point, but then you realize he's heading for the oil slick, and the other fighter pilot that Mark Rylance rescued is like, go now.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, get out. But yeah, it is a masterful exercise in just maintaining tension and suspense. One of the best examples I've seen in a film in general, absolutely, of this decade and this century so far.
Yeah. So, you know, let it not be said. Let this filibuster be preserved for historical purposes. I am not...
As they all will be.
I am not opposed to changing my mind or admitting that I was wrong or, like, I have a different view than I originally came in with, because I wouldn't say this makes me a convert necessarily, but I will say this. I guess we could wrap it up and go into final thoughts. I have to see this again, but even after one viewing, I'm ready to say that I think this is my favorite Nolan film.
Wow. I honestly cannot blame you in the slightest. I will have to see it again, and I will have to reevaluate reevaluate my rankings, but unquestionably, this is the best movie I've seen this year. It's one of the best movies I've seen, period. It is incredible.
I have to think about that far, but I will say that this is my dark horse. The Dark Horse Award for this summer goes to this one for me.
That's great. And so as far as ranking it, you'd put it at number one.
I put it at number one. I put Memento as number two, and I put Insomnia as number three.
I'd probably do Batman Begins, Dark Knight, I'm looking over it. I have them on my shelf right over here. I'm looking at them. Maybe Inception. Actually, I might put Dunkirk as number three. Like it is that good.
Like again, like I have to see it again. I have to think about it because it, you know, recency bias and all that. But like, this was the first time I had walked out of a Nolan experience fully loving just about everything. Every other time I felt like I liked it, but there was something that bothered me. Here, there was very little that bothered me. The only thing that I found disconcerting was I don't know what to call anybody.
Yeah, I'm completely on board. I adored it. And I hope I can see it again in 70mm IMAX. I want to take advantage of that again. But yeah,
I just want to see it again, period.
Yeah, exactly. I don't care how I see it as long as I get to see it again.
So, I mean, this is... I hesitate calling anything a perfect movie, so I'll say that this is like a 9.5 out of 10, and the 0.5 would have come from the character names. That's it.
I love that. Yeah, I'd go ahead and give it a perfect 10. I'll do it. It was completely effective in what it was trying to do, so I'd go so far as to call it a masterpiece.
But yes, Tristan Lee, mark it down. I loved a Christopher Nolan film.
This is it. This is a pivotal moment in filibuster history, in the history of life in general. People should be paying attention to this.
And again, like I said, I may come across as a stubborn asshole on some of these podcasts, but I'm never opposed to changing my mind or eating crow or admitting that I was wrong.
There you go. That's what it's all about, is being willing to accept it and to see the fault in yourself and to be willing to change. And that's what it's all about. That's what Christopher Nolan is all about. I don't think that's true.
No, I don't think that's true. I half expected you to go into like the end speech from Rocky IV. Like, if I can change, you could change.
Everybody. Yeah, that's what we need. We need Christopher Nolan to do a remake of Rocky IV. It'll be perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll see. I don't think that would be in his wheelhouse, but you know, he's unpredictable. But, that's one of the things that I do admire about him.
There you go. So I guess that's it for this episode. Yeah. We both love Dunkirk. See it by all means necessary. Hopefully you haven't listened and been spoiled. But go see Dunkirk, please.
Yes. And Sean, where can everybody find you online?
I am on Twitter at YayShonderman. I want to hear everyone's thoughts about Dunkirk, so feel free to reach out to me there. What about you, Matt?
And I am at mhansen0207, H-A-N-S-E-N. Likewise, I would love to have discussions about Dunkirk. I definitely want to see it again. And I had so much fun talking about it with you, so I think it's great.
Likewise.
I think it's great that the fan and the skeptic agreed on this film.
Yeah, that's the power of this movie, I think, is that it is crossing, bringing people together in ways no one thought was possible.
So until next time, we will remain here at the filibuster and we will never surrender.
Farewell.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.